Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. And it's a pleasure to give the seminar again for PI. And sorry that it's remote, but it's a pleasure anyway. So I'll be talking about my recent work, of course, but just nothing to do with gravity. So I will try to connect a little bit at the beginning with why I ended up doing this, but I hope you won't mind those quantum gravity seminar that I will be speaking about field theories on flat space. And so so the origin is it is coming from quantum gravity in some way. So the models I will be talking about is are tensor models, which were introduced in the beginning of the 90s by Ambjörn et al. As one possible definition of discretized Euclidean quantum gravity. The idea was that you have a tensor transforming in some some field in zero dimension. You can think about it. There's no space-time to start with. You just have a tensor object, TABC, with ABC indices, and they transforms under some tensor representation of some group, for example, ON. So here you have three copies of ON. From this, you build a kind of partition function, and find with an action which has as vertices, for example, this one, where the indices in this case are contracted, are three indices and in each tensor, and you see they are contracted on different tensors. A, B goes to on this other one, and C goes down here. And this is the standard representation familiar to many people here in the quantum gravity, where you have one tensor here on each external edge, but there are three triple lines that represent the indices, and so this represents the pattern of contraction, A going here, B going there, and C going here. And this vertex you can also interpret as tetrahedron, and then the Feynman diagrams give you the gluings of all these tetrahedra, and so you have an interpretation of the Feynman amplitudes, the Feynman expansion of the Gauss integral as a summation over Simplicial manifolds. Now, this approach had several limitations. First, there was no analytical tools, no large and limit known back then, no other methods of solution, and very degenerate ways to glue tetrahedra were allowed. Moreover, so that was studied by numerical simulations, and no semi-classical limit, no second order phase transition was found. So so these tensor models were revived sometime later by Razvan et al, who discovered that actually there is a large N limit for these models, and for various versions of these models, and that this limit is dominated by Mellonic diagrams. So that's why we call this now the Mellonic limit. However, I will describe in a moment what these Mellonic diagrams are more in detail. Well, the main problem was that melons are essentially branched polymers. So this was shown by Gurao and Ryan in 2013. So they have, if you interpret them, I mean, from the geometrical point of view, of the, this represent Simplicial manifolds, which are the continuum limit, they are branched polymers with Hausdorff dimension 2. So it's the not so interesting phase for quantum gravity, and was already known. So here, of course, it's nice that one finds it analytically, but yeah, the connection was here with simulations from dynamical triangulations where we're done with parameters kappa naught and kappa four. And kappa naught, which is kind of inverse Newton, bare Newton constant, it's related to, it's proportional to log n. So large N means you go to large kappa naught, you are somewhere in this phase with branch polymers, which. So the whole problem from quantum gravity point of view is to find a way to escape this this phase. I will not talk about that. but some years later, a bit more recently, 2016, there was some renewed interest in this melonic limit because from some unexpected direction for us, more from string theorists. So because of the SYK model, which is a model of N Majorana fermions in one dimension, which have a coupling constant, which is chosen to be random, and it couples, say, Q fields. So it's a tensor of rank Q, and so it's a random tensor. and this model was received quite some attention because in the large N limit has a melonic dominance. The diagram is a melonic. And this leads to the fact that you have actually a CFT, a conformal solution in the infrared. Now, usually, you know, one can try to associate CFT, some dual ADS theory in one dimension higher. In this case, this is thought to describe some ADS2 times perhaps some compact space, which in turn can be maybe thought as describing the microscopics of near extremal black holes. So this was the motivation for this string community. Now the same limit and then the same so conformal solution in the infrared can be obtained without introducing a disorder coupling, but just having a proper field theory. If the fields themselves, the fermions, are in some tensor representation. This was noticed by Witten and independently by Klebanov and Tarnopolsky, who pointed out that then tensor models can be a nice replacement of the SYK model. Sorry. So, in particular, they would have no quench disorder, as I said. They would have a symmetry from a global symmetry from the beginning, so that one could actually gauge this symmetry, which is not possible in the SYK model. And also, there was a lot of work from the tensor model community on understanding also subleading corrections and the 1/n expansion. So, that could be used. Now, oops. However, this motivated us to look a little bit in some other direction, because as we saw, this large limit of tensor had some application, origin in quantum gravity, was found to have an unexpected application in this SYK model. And then we thought, why not find other applications of this limit? One immediate one is to apply to quantum field theory in higher dimensions. So in fact, the large N limit was originally very much studied for quantum field theories in higher dimensions. So the historical examples are the vector and matrix models or matrix field theories, whose large N limit has been introduced a long time ago to study possibly non-perturbative aspects. So the question can be, can the melonic limit serve as a toy model to help us better understand some non-perturbative aspects of quantum field theory? And this will be the topic of my talk. So I will be talking about the tensor models on d-dimensional flat background, no gravity. And in the second part, I will talk also about a melonic field theory, which is not even a tensor model at all.
But it has surprisingly similar behavior to the tensor models. And I should say this is work I've done in collaboration with Razvan and with Sabine Ribey and Nicolas Delport, who are students here, and Kenta Suzuki, who's a postdoc. So, in order to fix ideas, let me remind you about the larger limit for vector and matrix models, briefly. So these were the standard examples which have been introduced first in the literature. So the DOE model, perhaps the first, and the larger limit is dominated by cactus diagrams, a little bit like the one I drew here. it's interesting that leads typically to a solvable Schwinger-Dyson equation for the two-point function, in fact, which reduces to a mass gap equation. Most famously, this was used in the Gross-Navier model to show non-perturbative dynamical mass generation. But somehow it's also a little bit too simple. It's from the normalization point of view, it has very simple behavior. There's no wave function normalization. it's very much a one loop like structure. And the other matrix models was famously brought up by Toft for the as a possible approach to Yamil's theory in large limit. But you can also just think of some scalar fields in the bifundamental representation of O(n) square. And the large limit is dominated by planar diagrams. And my many applications in more recently in the SCFT and so on. And many models are solvable in zero dimensions. However, in higher dimensions, it remains very, very challenging. It's very difficult. Planar diagrams is a big simplification, but yet you cannot, if you have to evaluate Feynman integrals for arbitrary planar diagrams, they're still hard. So I've shown you here O(n) model, O(n) square, so it's very natural to ask oneself, what about if you go on O(n) cube, O(n) fourth? So that's what we call tensor models. So there will be fields with transforming as tensors of rank greater or equal to 3 under some global symmetry group. For example, here O(n) cube again. And they will be defined by an invariant action under this group, containing at least one term which has no larger symmetry than this. Because sometimes, because sometimes people are confused and propose other models as tensor models, but which in fact have, they are essentially matrix models or vector models. For example, this first invariant, phi ABC, as in fact, an O of n cubed invariants. So it's essentially just a vector invariant rewritten with more indices. But what do you really mean by tensor? Something that that breaks these invariants down to O n cubed, like the tetrahedral interaction that I showed you before. Now we use a slightly different representation in which the tensor usually represent them as a vertex and the indices as lines coming out of this vertex with different colors. Because we are looking at O(n) cube, so there's no symmetry on the indices, on the permutations of the indices. So we distinguish the indices by color. So first index, second index, so they cannot be exchanged. So these two invariants can be represented in this way. So when two vertices are connected by an edge means that there is a contraction of an index. And this tetrahedron is like an all-to-all interaction for four fields. Now, So let's to fixate this and to go more into a concrete model. This what we studied with Razvan mostly has been this quartic ON cube model. So we take an action, first of all, okay, there's a free part, which of course has been quadratic in phi, doesn't have much of a tensor structure in the sense I was saying before. So, but I stress here that we allow in general, would be interesting to consider fractional Laplacians in the kinetic term, which are have been considered also, might seem a bit exotic to some, but they have been considered quite a bit in literature, also in statistical physics. They are known as long-range models. When zeta, the power zeta here is smaller than one, this can be thought as some kind of, if you discretize, for example, on a lattice, you can think of the easy model with the not nearest neighbor interaction, but some long-range interaction. That's why the name. And of course, these different powers modifies the canonical dimension of the fields. And this is interesting for doing RG, in fact. And it's been used also by mathematicians to do more rigorous RG, in fact. Now, the interesting part is the interacting part, which, as I said, has to break the symmetry of this kinetic terminus. So in particular, we consider all possible invariants up to built out of at most four fields. This will include a mass term, the tetrahedron I showed you before, and then there's these other two terms, which we call pillow and double trace, from which we use these subscripts to remind ourselves which coupling is related to which. Here I also included, here there is this one is unique, the double trace is unique. The pillows, there are three of them under permutation of the colors. But here we consider a model with the color permutation symmetry. So, 2015, Karotz et Tanasa showed precisely for this model, although they were working in zero dimensional, they had no integral over X, but on the large hand point of view, of course, the integral over X doesn't matter. So they showed that this model, the free energy as an expansion in 1 over N, governed by an index, non-negative number called the degree. Gerald, this is also called the Gurau degree because Razvan was the first to introduce this, but for different kind of model than this. So that's why here I mentioned Karotz and Tanasa. Now, in order to tell you a little bit more what are these, the leading order diagrams, which here we should have omega equals zero. First, let me remind you a little bit of the perturbative expansion of these models. So you do just the usual Feynman diagram expansion, and weak contraction will represented by a new line with different colors, here black. So for example, if I have two vertices which are tetrahedra, then I join the eight fields by four propagators, which are this line in black, and I can represent it like this. This one is very useful representation for keeping track of the powers of N. However, when we do field theory and we want to do, you know, integrals or momentum space and so on, it's useful to think of this diagram in the standard representation, which you shrink this blue, red, and green lines to a point, and you have standard Feynman diagram representations on these two. Going to this one, and this eight figure eight was this other diagram. So one is useful for doing combinatorics. The other is more, you know, say what we usually use doing quantum field theory. Now these two diagrams, I didn't choose them by accident. I mean they are kind of diagrams that appear at omega equals zero, and more in general, the diagrams that appear, we call them melon tadpole. So they are mixture of tadpole-like diagrams, a little bit like which are generated by the pillow, and they are the same kind of diagrams that are generated also in the the vector model. So what's more interesting, as I was saying, is the Mallory diagrams. And these are, you can think them in the following way. You have a fundamental vacuum Mellonic diagram, which has just two vertices. Now I use the second representation of Feynman diagrams. So I have two quartic interactions, which actually are this tetrahedra there, and they are joined like before. And I am allowed to now insert Mellonic two-point functions, which are obtained by this, by opening an edge. I obtain a two-point function, and I can insert it in like this. And then I can repeat this, and only this. If I repeat only this move, I obtain Mellonic, whatever, all the Mellonic diagrams in this way. No other moves are allowed. So these are all the kind of diagrams that appear at omega equals zero, plus the pillow and double trace generate also tadpole diagrams. So this was interesting because in zero dimension you had many more solvable models, and these were studies I was seeing more from the quantum gravity point of view. There are interesting generalization of the SYK model with this. With this method, which are also solvable. And so more recently, we've been studying, as I was saying, higher dimension model based on this. So the interesting thing about one first interesting thing about this Mellonic limit is that these Mellon tadpole diagrams are built by recursive insertion of two-point graphs into the a given diagram. And so this implies that actually the Schwinger-Dyson equation for the two-point function has simple structure. So here is the generic Schwinger-Dyson equation. It tells you the inverse full two-point function is the inverse free propagator minus the self-energy. This is valid for any field theory. Now this simplifies in the large n limit for Mellonic theories with the self-energy that is given by a Mellonic part, which is just this Mellonic two-point function insertion with full propagators on the lines, and tadpole from pillow and double trace. So this kind of contribution. So in formula, sigma is lambda g cube minus term linear in gxx. So you see the tadpole is kind of ultra-local, it's GXX, so actually gives you only mass corrections, mass renormalization, while the Mellon is bilogal and actually gives you also wave function renormalization. However, it's a closed equation, which is, this is the interesting thing. So you plug this back in here, you have an equation for G. Now, for the short range case for the standard Laplacian kinetic term, the Schwinger-Dyson equation can be solved in the limit p going to zero by these ansatz, gp minus one proportional to p to the d half, d being the space time dimension here. And this is much larger for d smaller than four than p squared in the limit of p going to zero. So, so you can solve this equation in the IR limit essentially and find a conformal solution because this is a scaling solution. Because like it's just a power law, there's no mass and so on. Now there's an interesting choice of long range, which take zeta to be d over four. Well, this is the choice that makes such that the quartic interactions are exactly, they are marginal in power counting. Because you have four fields, each have dimension d over four. So the quartic vertex has dimension d, so the coupling is dimensionless. And moreover, the Schwinger-Dyson equation can be solved exactly because now the free propagator we chose by hand to be the same as what here was just the infrared solution. So
with zeta equal d over 4, you remember the action we had. So here essentially a p to the 2 zeta. So for zeta equal d over 4, you have essentially p to the d half. And so you don't neglect, you don't need to neglect the free part in order to get a solution, and you have an exact solution at all p. And essentially, so yes, the solution is this with the coefficient which solves an equation which I wrote here. It's a quartic equation that can be solved. Actually, it can be also be understood as the generating function of four Catalan numbers. So it's essentially combinatorial. This means that you are resumming all the melonic insertion in the Tupin function. And in fact, this kind of generating function appeared in the solution of the zero dimensional models. And here it just appeared as a coefficient of the Tupin function. Now, because of this interesting structure of closed Schwinger-Dyson equation, actually it's useful to introduce a so-called 2pi formalism. This 2pi stands for two particle irreducible, and it goes like this. You start from a path integral over some fields phi with their action. You couple some source as usual to phi, but you can also couple a source to two copies of phi. So you have a bilinear source, let's say. So W, the generator of connected diagram, is defined as the log of this partition function, but then you can take a double Legendre transform with respect to J and K. So you get to define an action gamma of phi and G, which can be shown as this form as kind of the three-level part, which is just S of phi. There's a one-loop structure term and higher order part. So with the following, which are built with the following Feynman rules, the vertices are obtained from the expansion of the original action around the background field phi. And the propagator is just G, which is one of the arguments of this function. So there is a the propagator here becomes a free variable of this effective action. And this gamma 2 of phi and g is given by the sum of all the two particle irreducible vacuum graphs. And the catch is that you obtain the usual theory, the real two-point function by going on shells. So you solve the equations of motion for this theory, for this effective action, and this will give you the two-point function and the one-point function. This is nothing new, this known since a long time, but the idea is that this is very well suited for a theory in which two-point functions play a big role, like here. So in particular here, if we want to build a 2pi effective action for melonic theory, we find that it's very simple because there is only one melonic graph, which is also two particle irreducible. Maybe for two particle irreducible means that if you cut two edges, you don't disconnect the graph. Since all the other melonic diagrams are obtained by inserting two-point function inside this fundamental melonic diagram, they are all two particle reducible. So the only irreducible diagram is this one, the fundamental one. So this simplifies things a lot. So in fact, you can write then a large N, the full 2pi effective action, standard term as before, and then the 2pi part is just given by a g to the fourth, which is this diagram, and a g squared, which is the other diagram I had here. So this gives you a g of xx squared and this g of xy to the fourth. And yeah, there. Now you do take the equation of the first variation of this action respect to g and set it to zero, you recover the Schwinger-Dyson equation I showed you before. But you can do also more. You can use it, if you take the second variation respect to g, this is related now to the four-point function, But in particular to the four-point function, which is connected in the S channel, going from 1, 2 to 3, 4. So you subtract this disconnected piece. Here you have the full four-point function, and you subtract this disconnected part. This is equal to the inverse of the second variation of gamma respect to G. And here you can define Bethe-Salpeter kernel, which is related to the second variation of this gamma 2. Gamma 2 was just this part here. So this inverse second variation, you can write it as one inverse of 1 minus k, essentially. That means something, sometimes two propagators at the end. So this is a geometric series in this Bethe-Salpeter kernel. You can interpret it like this. So the full two-point function minus this part is kind of a series of ladders in this kernel. What this kernel in general can be very complicated. So they are not just what we would call ladder diagrams. They can have all sort of two particle irreducible parts in here. But in the case of Melonic theories, this kernel becomes very easy. It's just made by these two components. So again, the part that comes from the tetrahedra and the part that comes from pillow and double traces like this. So when you substitute this here, you will get really a ladder, plus sometimes they join like a chain. And so it's a mixture of chains and ladders. Now this give an interesting structure to the renormalization of the four-point function, so renormalization of the couplings. So I will concentrate here on the long-range model. In this case, because of the non-local structure of the K term, there's actually no wave function normalization because, you know, counter terms are local, so there's no wave function normalization. And moreover, you can check that this this structure of four-point functions never generates something that looks like the tetrahedron. So actually there is no radiative correction to the tetrahedron, there is no wave function normalization. So the tetrahedron coupling is exactly marginal. So you can use it as a small, as a parameter that you can take small and control your theory with this parameter. The other two couplings instead are not marginal, but they have a beta function that goes a large n. Again, you can write at least the structure to all orders. So they are quadratic in pillow or double trace, let's say. So they are exactly quadratic polynomials, a leading order in n. And the coefficients, however, are a function of this exactly marginal tetrahedron coupling. And the structure of these coefficients can be understood from, they come from, you know, ladders without pillow or tetrahedra. B1 is a ladder with one pillow, and B2 is ladders with two pillows at the end. I mean, because of its quadratic equation, so now if looking for fixed points is simple, you just have to solve a quadratic equation. And of course, it's still difficult to write this B coefficient to all orders because you need to evaluate these Feynman diagrams. However, yeah, you can do it to some extent. And for example, leading order, we find that the fixed point for pillows, there are these two solutions. And now you start to see that there is a square root of minus g square. So this means for, if you take real tetrahedron coupling, you'll have complex solutions and complex critical exponents. However, you see immediately that if you take imaginary tetrahedron coupling, then both will be real. Now, I don't remember if I... Maybe I anticipate something I comment later, probably. why would you take an imaginary coupling? It sounds something a bit unusual also. But in fact, you have to notice that the tetrahedron is not a square of something. It's not positive definite quantity. So actually, this is an unbounded from below object. You remember, it's written in fields, it's like this, it doesn't have any positivity property.
So in fact, it's a little bit, you could think of it a little bit like the phi cube theory. And in phi cube theory, it's actually quite standard to take imaginary coupling. That's like the Li-Yang model. There's a question.
Yes, there is a question by Ram.
Yeah, Dario, maybe, so that's where you're going. Is it real? You know, a long time ago with David Luap, we looked at the non-perturbative completion of tensor models before all of that. You know, we show that, yeah, exactly. If you want really to have the, you know, being able to Borel so resum all the series, you need to have a certain relationship between the coupling. So is that related to this old result about Borel resummations of the GFTs?
I'm not sure because I'm not doing GFT here. So
it would be the same. You're doing we just looked. We were looking at the model given by the pilo and the tetrahedra. So we were studying the stability.
But you didn't have a space-time this field. Right? I mean, my hope here.
It does not really matter because it's all about the stability of the. Yeah, there may be an extension with the space-time, but that the fact that the potential is not positive definite is essentially the key point for Borel resummation.
Okay, that's an interesting observation. I don't know how to. Yeah, I don't know how one could relate it.
Well, as you're saying, the large n limit in some sense, the space-time dependence is not really the major.
No, well, it is there. It's very important because all the thing I'm talking about here is about CFTs, and I will be talking about CFT. So the whole conformal structure is okay in the space-time, and just take the large n limit to select the diagrams, and then these diagrams, of course, they are still there.
There should be a link between the non-perturbative completion of the theory. Anyway, I mean, it's interesting to ask.
Maybe some aspects which might be related, like a little bit like I was saying for the two-point function. Of course, there is something which is there also in zero dimension, which is this Catalan generating function. But of course, in zero dimension, you don't have the conformal aspects of it.
Well, I guess the question is that theory Borel resummable, the one you're talking about?
I don't know. I would say, well, for the 4-point, I mean, definitely the 2-point function is resummable up to the critical point. And I would say at the fixed point also the 4-point function, because we can actually write an explicit, rather explicit form for the 4-point function. So I would say it is, yes.
But that depends on the value of the coupling. So
it depends on the value of coupling, of course. There might be some critical coupling beyond which it's not. So like this Catalan wave function, of course, has a finite radius convergence. And precisely, it depends on this margin, exactly marginal coupling. And so if you have a small coupling, you're within. So the important thing is you have a finite radius convergence as opposed to a zero radius of convergence of usual.
Yeah. No, but usually the Borel resummation comes from the fact that this GT has to be negative, or the pilo, you know, like the relative sign between the pilo and the tetrahedron. This is related to what you're saying later. We cannot take both coupling to be positive and have Borel resummation.
I see. Well, I don't know too much about that. But in our case, what we see is that the pilo, we can take it to be positive, but we have to take the tetrahedron to be imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was trying to say was that being unbounded from below is not an unnatural thing to do. It's a little bit like in cubic theories and so on. It's quite common, meaningful thing to do. So So going back to the four-point function, as I was saying, because of this structure we had here, actually, because of the conformal limit, one can actually give a very concrete expansion for this. Conformal field theory is known as conformal partial wave expansion. If you take this S-channel connected four-point function, this decomposes in the following way. You have some parts which is group theoretical, is labeled by the reducible representations of the conformal, the Euclidean conformal group, so spin and scaling dimensions. You have a measure factor, you have conformal blocks, which important role in well-known in conformal field theory. And there is this part which where K is the eigenvalue of the Bethe-Salpeter kernel I was talking about. So this is a theory dependent part. Now, from this representation, if you move the contour here to the integration to the right, which you can do because conformal blocks have decay at positive H, then you pick up the poles of this term here, which are located at the solution of K equal one. When you pick up those poles, then you have the residue would give you some coefficient, which, and so you reduce this expression to the standard operator product expansion, and which I remind, there is also from a field theory, you have, when you have a product of two fields, this you expand it in primary operators, and the coefficient is the OP coefficient. And when you do this for field 1, 2 here and field 3, 4 there, you obtain an OP expansion of the four-point function.
So, Dario, sorry.
Another question, yes.
Yeah, just a question. Is it obvious that all the poles are positive definite? So that is, the theory is unitary.
No. This will come. So the we look for the solutions. They can be complex as well. In fact, often we find complex solutions in some one complex solution. Before getting there, let me see. Did I forget to say something here? No, I guess. I was saying that by looking at this solution of this equation, then you find this the spectrum of operators that appear in the OPS, and so you have to look at the solution of this equation. And now in this Mellonic model K, you can evaluate it explicitly. This eigenvalue has this form in terms of some gamma functions. And the solutions can be found analytically by expanding a small g, which I remind you was a free parameter that we can take small, or numerically a finite coupling. So here, for example, it's a plot of the zero spin zero case. You just look at the intersection with at one. So in general, we find they have the following form. They have the form essentially of the dimension of operator of this form with two fields, and a certain number of derivatives. There's j uncontracted derivatives which give you the spin, and plus you can have 2n contracted derivatives. So this is the dimension, twice the dimension of field, this d half, plus j plus 2n is the number of derivatives, plus you have an anomalous dimension. And this anomalous dimension we can compute exactly from this formula by solving k equal 1. And a small g, we find again some square root of minus g for the case of zero spin and zero derivatives, while all the others have start with g square and they're positive. In fact, you can you can show that they are all real. They come from intersections, of course, like this, and they say real finite g. While this first one is in complex again at the real g, but it can be made real by taking g imaginary, only up to some point again. So if you take g imaginary, but you increase the absolute value, this curve here goes up, and at some point it crosses again, and these two solutions merge and become complex again. So taking imaginary G, again, you have real solutions, that you have in a finite range of G. So there is some critical value of G beyond which you find complex solutions again. So by taking this large limit and this imaginary coupling, so we do find the real CFT and compatible with the unitarity. In fact, all the dimensions are above unitarity bounds. The OPE coefficients are real. And we checked more. So I'm going a bit slow. So maybe here I skip. I just want to remind. So we checked also other aspects of it, other OPE coefficient and other dimensions, and all seems to be compatible with unitarity and reality of the CFT. I wanted to talk briefly about a different model, which I thought might be interesting to people working on spin networks and so on. This is, again, nothing to do with quantum gravity, but at least there is some familiar things coming in. This is a model that Amit Rozhinsky introduced many years ago, and it has the following form. So you have now M fields, which are arranged even more like in a vector-like form. You still have kinetic term, mass term, and interaction is cubic, and it's mediated by a Wigner 3JM symbol. So this is the only cubic interaction which is invariant under SO3 when, you know, this N fields transform in the irreducible representation of SO3 labeled by J. So here we take N equal to J plus one, and you have to take it even. Otherwise, this 3JM symbol is anti-symmetric, and this gives you a zero here. So for even J, you have and N equal to J plus one, you have this action. And what Amit Rozhinsky found that in the larger limit, this model is melonic. They didn't talk about melons back then, but rereading it, you recognize things. And they did actually a very similar analysis to what I presented, of course, a bit more old-fashioned way of some things, but there were some mistakes. And so we decided to revisit it a little bit, to generalize it, and also to correct some of those mistakes. So in particular, we consider again a long-range model. Now you take D over six in order to have this interaction to be marginal at all D. Because the Z that D over six give you a five, which has dimension D over three. And so the interesting thing, which this is not part of my work, but more what Amit Rozhinsky had done, but I wanted to mention for the people there, this. So to how to show the larger limit. So the Feynman diagrams have the following expression. There's some combinatorial factor C, there's a usual Feynman diagram part. I remind you that here we put by hand the square root of n, so it's here, to the number of vertices. Then you have some integrals to do, as you're doing quantum field theory, but forget about that. There is a term that just comes from the SO3 representation here. In order to evaluate this, you just need to look at closed diagrams, because two-point diagrams and three-point diagrams, they are proportional to the invariant metric, which here were represented by a single line, and to the 3JM symbol that I represent by a vertex like this. You just have to trace this guy, and this is the proportionality coefficient, and or contract this full three-point function with the 3JM, and this gives you the proportionality coefficient again. Now, it is easy to show that if you take any diagram which is melonic, now trivalent melons, and instead before I talked about melons with vertices which are four-valent, but it's trivalent, but still melonic trivalent graphs, they have this factor goes like n to the one minus half number of vertices. So if you plug it back here, this minus v half cancel with this, so the amplitude of melons is over there n. Next one uses one is to show that the other graphs are subleading by the same
by this consequence of this, actually you can show that is a two-point reducible diagrams can be split like this, and three-point reducible diagrams like that. So in actual, you can reduce the amplitude of any closed diagram with two n vertices to a product of three particle irreducible components. And these three particle irreducible components are what are known as 3nj symbols. So here comes the crucial point, which is not proved, but has some strong evidence. Amit Rudzinski studied the 3nj symbols of first and second kind analytically and the numerics for higher order symbols. And the conclusion was that the 3nj symbols scale as like the melon a bit more. So there is this alpha prime, which makes them subleading respect to the melon. This alpha prime depends on the 3nj in particular but, and that you're looking at, but for all, based on this evidence, it seems that all 3nj symbols are subleading respect to the melon. Would be interesting to find. I asked Valentano, other people, if this had been proved in the meantime, because this was 1979, but yeah, it doesn't seem so, and I don't know. It would be interesting, I think. However, so one, and this model, after you accept this large and melonic limit, then there it has very similar properties to what I discussed before as zero vanishing beta function. Now there are no other couplings. It's this unique cubic coupling. So there is no equivalent of pill or double trace to look at. You can solve again the two-point function like this and find the spectrum of operators that appear in the OP. Now, there's for finish, I want to mention one other model, which is also very similar, although non-melonic. this was introduced by Kazakov and others, and it's actually a matrix model. And it was obtained as some special limit of reduction of n equal 4 Swegian Mills, but it doesn't matter. Essentially, you have two matrix scalar fields, and they are in the joint of SUN, and you have this action. It's a single trace part with this only this interaction, which is non-Hermitian. Notice that there is this guy, but there's not, it's missing the Hermitian conjugate of this vertex. And then you have some double trace terms which are needed for normalization. However, the main part of the thing is the first line gives you fishnet diagrams. That's why you call this model fishnet model. Meaning, for example, the you know a vertex with of an operator of phi to the n is normalized by diagrams of this type. Here's the you know the operator insertion in this case in this drawing is an phi to the 10. And it's renormalized by very regular diagrams that somehow they look like a fishnet or like a spider web to me. But yeah. So this model again has no wave function normalization in this mainly because of this fishnet structure. But moreover, in this smaller than four, they also have a long range thing. So it's a little bit like our case. Now, fishnets are very different from melons, but it so turns out that if you look at the normalization of these double trace terms, you are looking at normalization of four-point functions, and a fishnet with four external fields like this, it's actually like a ladder again, because you have to cycle of length through this. You can think of this as one case of this in which you have only two lines. It's here, yeah, there are 10 lines. If you put only two and the rest, you know, move them all. This you can also draw essentially like this. So there are fishnets for four-point functions. They are equivalent to the ladders we have in melonic field theories. So they have a very similar structure of the Bethe-Salpeter equation and so on. However, they usually the Kirill coupling, which and with which they find also complex dimensions. So these complex dimensions, there are not any complex dimensions. They usually come of this form, d half plus I alpha. And they originate, if you want, by the merging of a coupling with this, of an operator with its shadow, but this doesn't matter. The important thing is that whereas complex dimensions, in principle, they imply non-unitarity, but you know, non-unitary CFT can have applications in statistical physics and so on. So it's not obvious whether you should discard theories with complex dimensions. And in fact, they have been complex CFTs have been proposed to as an interesting topic of study by a number of people, particularly this paper by Richkov et al. However, dimensions precisely of this form, people usually think from ADS CFT point of view, they correspond in the bulk to in ADS d plus one dimension to fields with a mass m, which violates the Bredner-Lohner-Friedman bound. So, you know, dimension delta in the CFT dimension at the mass of the fields in ADS d plus one are related by this formula. And you see that when m square becomes smaller than minus d square over four, here you get an imaginary contribution. So you get exactly d half plus imaginary stuff. And when you have violation of this BF bound, you have a tachyonic instability in ADS. So it's usually assumed by ADS CFT argument that also CFTs with these dimensions will be unstable. So, but this, I repeat, can be avoided by taking an imaginary coupling. So this brings me to the conclusions. I try to show you that the Mellonic limit, you know, it can be interesting QFT. Tensors are somehow easier than matrices, but richer than vectors. And they can be usefully studied by means of the 2PI effective action. And we have concentrated very much on this ON-cube model with quartic interaction. We looked also at sextic models and other variations. And I showed you also that there are other models which are not tensors, but they have similar properties. Of course, this was SYK was what brought us a little bit in this direction. It's not tensor model, which has also Mellonic limit. I showed you this Amitrojinsky model. And in some ways, this fishnet model also has similar properties. So, this all these models go a bit in the direction of trying to extract some new insights from quantum field theory from this new large limit. Complex dimensions tend to occur, but they can be avoided in such range of couplings. And there are many open questions. So we would like to use this Mellonic limit as a tool to do some rigorous things in normalization. Also to, we would like to understand also classification of the CFTs that arise in this limit. The holographic dual has been discussed because this started from SYK in D equal one was motivation was that, but there has also been, you know, higher dimensions. So the ON model has been argued by Klebanov, Polyakov to be dual to higher spin theory. So there's been a question around of whether these tensors models would also have some higher spin dual. And of course, I would like to find some application, also real physics application of these models in some statistical model, but for the moment, we have no idea. And as I mentioned before, it would be nice actually to prove this 3NJ bound that I showed before. And who knows, maybe find even more limits to tensor models to enrich this picture. And I stop here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dario, for this nice and interesting presentation. So are there questions from students first?
Yeah.
So at the moment, I don't see questions from students, but there is an anonymous question that I'm also copying in the chat. So are you aware of any result that studied the critical phenomena phase transition in, for instance, ON2 tensor field theory coupled to a fermion field in the large N limit?
Sorry, say it again. You say you copy it in the chat, let me see.
Yes, it is in the chat, if you want.
No, I'm not particularly aware of this. No. Also, I would say that ON square, as I said, I wouldn't call it a tensor model, it's more like
matrix model. We, it is,
in our standard language, say from this area, we call it a matrix model. Yes.
Okay. Okay. So next, there is a question by Bianca.
Yeah. Hi. It's two questions. One: why did Amit and the other guy? Do you know why they did introduce this model? Was it motivated by something?
Yes, so they were thinking about the POTS model.
Mm-hmm.
They were interested in the POTS model, which is also described by cubic theory, but with some discrete symmetry. And so they wanted to introduce a larger limit, but when you have discrete symmetry, it's not very feasible. So they enlarged the model to, they added to it this SO3 symmetry, so to have a continuous symmetry and be able to take a larger limit.
And so, so as far as I understand, you construct a kind of a large family of possibly new conformal field series. Do these models which come from these tensor models, are they kind of different as a class from other conformal field series?
I would say the claim is that these are new CFTs at the moment. They have some similarities, as I was saying, with this fishnet model is not a tensor model, but it has some similarities. So of course, there are also differences, because if you look at higher endpoint functions, they will be different. They are similar at the level of the four-point function, but then for the rest, they are different. So.
So it's exploring the range of CFTs.
Okay. CFTs and trying to normalization group, trying to find your points.
So is there something typical about? Yeah. Is there something typical about melonic CFTs in some sense? Is there some property which stands out compared to other CFTs? Maybe I'm asking a stupid question.
No, it's fair. But yes, let's see. Well, I don't know how to answer, but this for me, the structure of this diagrammatics is interesting. So what stands out is the fact that they can be solved. You can solve the Schinger-Dyson equation.
It has some spectrum
of OPE. So the fact that you can solve certain things, you're in higher dimensions, is non-trivial, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I think makes them interesting.
Mm-hmm. So it's a large class of solvable models and giving you safety.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, next. So I see that the student Hank unmuted himself. So maybe you want to ask a question? No. Doesn't seem so. Okay, then Carlo. Carlo, you have to unmute yourself first.
Thank you, Alicia. Dario, this is maybe going the same direction of Bianca, probably. I've listened to the presentation. I've missed a lot because there's a lot of technology that you use that I don't know, and even language that I don't know. So I probably have missed the key points in your presentation. But mm-hmm. what I mostly have missed is the overall what is going on. I mean, you were totally honest and very clear at the beginning, saying this is nothing to do with quantum gravity. Fine, it has to do with quantum gravity. So it has to do with what? In the sense, it's just, you know, mathematics, or you put here and there, oh, maybe it could be used for, I don't know, liquid vapor or something, but it seemed not this your motivation. You're not interested in superfluid helium and study superfluid helium and say, look, there is a property of superfluid helium and try to capture it. Not at all.
No, so that we have already.
You do some definition and then compute something and then say, well, maybe it's going to be used for something. What is the logic here? You say,
well, it's
but they're not really field theories either.
Well, they are field theories. What do you mean? They're not really field theories.
Well,
they're field theories. Like, so the logic is the same of many. Sorry, it's the same logic of, say, the Grothendieck model or many other models, the N equal for
sure. I know, but I don't understand the logic.
The same logic of trying to find, to, you know, understand some things about quantum field theories, which, you know, real models are usually the most difficult ones, and we are not able to control everything. So for me, this is like toy model. Of course, I'm not, I've been very honest, I didn't say that this is a physical model of something. It's like a toy model, like it's a much, very much like N equal force Mahian Mills or the Grothendieck model.
Which I don't understand the meaning of them. So if the logic
is... there are things from which you can learn some aspects of quantum field theory. Mathematical aspects, but we would, of course, we would like
to learn these things. If there is the point is to learn something about quantum field theory, okay? Mm-hmm. What have we learned about quantum field theory? What is the message? Besides the fact that there's a certain definition where you can do some calculation. What, at the end of all that, I come from a different world. What are we learning about quantum field theory? Have we learned something we definitely didn't know, or we want to learn?
I'm doing my little step. If I had to learn something big about quantum field theory, that I would make more noise about it. But I am just... you know, there are little steps in learning some little more things about quantum field theory. So
what's the question? What's the question being asked?
Sorry?
What is the question? I understand it's a little step, and we all do this step. I mean, I do a little step, and you know, but I know the question. The question is, can we understand what happened in a black hole? Can we understand what the quantum property of gravity?
No, it's not my question. The question
is what? What is the question?
To control the quantum field theory non-perturbatively, for example. You know, this is all problems of trying to understand the perturbative more rigorously, the normalization group and existence of certain fixed points, how to classify the form of field theories. So there are many questions open from quantum field theory from a formal point of view. I understand you, I don't know if you want to push me into some question of some physical model that we want to answer. No, the questions are more like formal, from formal developments of quantum field theory, which hopefully would be useful once you know that in certain models you can prove certain statements, then, you know, in realistic models, maybe you cannot prove them, but you have a toy model example in which you can do it. It's always a proof of principle somehow that you can do certain things.
Carlo. I think that there are also other questions from other people. So eventually you can continue this discussion with Dario privately. And in particular, I see a question by Seth.
Yeah, hello there. So in the beginning, I remember you mentioned that tensor models are related, or like they were the different Euclidean quantum gravity models. So my question is there a formalism for Lorentzian models too, or do Lorentzian like things appear in these tensor models also?
Lorentzian signature, no, there is not a
formalism.
Yeah. Okay. As a CDT.
A CDT is only Lorentzian up to the very first page.
Before the big rotation.
Yes, so, yeah. So everything Euclidean. So CDT is a foliation and everything, but usually, yeah, you don't keep the Lorentzian signature very long.
Okay, so you say like these large n limits will still be for Euclidean field theories, like mostly results in Euclidean.
But the one theories. I mentioned in the first slide, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So are there questions possibly from people who didn't speak so far? Bianca, so do you still have a question? Or, okay.
That was just to maybe comment. So as conformal field theories, these are examples of rigorously defined, I mean, have a chance to be rigorously defined quantum field theories, no, with a new recompletion in some sense.
Yes.
Which does not happen too often.
Yes, so. What doesn't happen often is also, you know, to be able to prove that there is a fixed point in a non-trivial fixed point in a quantum field theory. So you know all the story. There's, I mean, I somehow came from there, right? The doing asymptotic safety show that there is a non-trivial fixed point for quantum gravity. Now, quantum gravity has its own difficulties and it's much more complicated theory. But we are not even usually able to prove that there is a non-trivial fixed point in much easier theories, you know, beyond the epsilon expansion. So by the large n limit, we hopefully able to find some non-trivial fixed points and show that at least in this limit they exist.
And you could apply functional renormalization flow, for instance, as a test for functional
could apply, but we didn't find a very useful way to see this. The Melonic limit truncates very nicely the 2 pi effective action, as I showed. Usually, functional RG works with the 1 pi effective action, and so it doesn't. We didn't find a nice way to use the FRG. So we didn't really need it. So usually it's FRG too. It's a way, it's an interesting tool for doing truncations, but here we have the control of the large n limit. So it's, yeah, we can prove the existence of these fixed points. And,
We thought we'd be thinking
a little bit about FRG because, of course, we have many friends using it. And, but, yeah, we didn't find a useful way of using it. Yeah.
Well, it's also Sylvain did it, no? Apply it to tensor models.
Sylvain did the for
GFTs.
GFTs.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, are there more questions or comments? Particular by students or people who didn't speak so far.
I did talk, but nice
yes.
talk.
Yeah, but,
anyway.
I think, but maybe since we have some time, I would also ask a couple of questions, if you don't mind, Dario. First, related to Bianca's question, you could still try to apply the functional normalization group for the to PI effective axon, right? So it has been redeveloped recently. So maybe this is something that you have in mind.
Yes, I know the we watched a talk also at the last ERG conference, and there were previous works also. Jan Pawlowski had done something on that, but it's somehow the 2BI effective action has a trivial flow equation when you write it like this. Though the non-trivial aspect is when you've done, I mean, then if you go on shell and put the two-point function on shell, so then you reduce to the usual 1PI effective action flow. So somehow, I don't know, I've been oscillating between thinking it's trivial or too difficult to use. That's when you write it in terms of 2PI effective action, it looks like a trivial flow, but then
yes, but the problem
doesn't tell you much actually. Then you have to go back to the 1PI, there is more complicated.
I thought it was more straightforward because of the simple structure of the Schwinger equation somehow. And also one small question that might be very basic, but so you have this theta parameter. Like really at the beginning in the definition of your model, and then you used to analyze these two cases where it is when it is one and when it is less than one. But so I'm a bit confused about the interpretation because you say that it is related to short or long range interactions. Mm-hmm. But in principle, I also don't see why it can't be bigger than one. So maybe in that case you have problems with unitarity. I see still might have an interpretation.
Yeah, it's a first of all probably with unitarity, but also then the action written like this. If you take theta bigger than one, then this is not all the relevant terms, because at the point if you take theta bigger than one, then the standard kinetic term becomes relevant. You would have a phi box phi that you should add among the interactions. And then it typically dominates and it brings you back to the class, universality class of the short range model. So really to find the long range universality class, you have to take theta smaller than one. I'm not sure if this was all about your question or you had.
Yes, so I still don't get why a kinetic term with a different, let's say a non-standard scaling corresponds to long range interactions.
Well, the terminology comes from usually easy model was called. So if you write, usually you know the standard one with zeta equal one, you can write it on a lattice, and this means you have the Laplacian becomes a nearest neighbor interaction of the lattice, gives you interaction with the nearest neighbor sites. Now when you write a non-local thing with the zeta like that, actually
I see
the power law. So actually it interacts with all the fields because there is a power law. In fact, the best way is not this, you can think of it as in Fourier space and then it just appears to zeta. But really this in real space, this is a kernel. You should think
there is
a two-point function here, like thing which went on x and y. Here I should be integrating on x and y, and actually it's relating different points. So
okay, now it is clear, thank you. One more time. So, are there further questions or comments? So, since this does not seem to be the case, I would like to thank Dario again for this nice talk and discussion, and also in particular because he gave this talk from Europe, so it's pretty late by him. So it would be great if you all could unmute yourself to thank Dario.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.